This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Now, if you're like me, you've often read a film review, you know, not to mention a book review, and whether you agreed with it or not, you've wished that you could just get a hold of the reviewer and tell him or her what you think. Well, tonight you actually will be able to speak to the reviewer himself, one of the most prominent in the business. Tony Scott joined the New York Times as a film critic 16 years ago, and 4 years later was named a chief critic. Before that, he served on the editorial staffs of Lingua Franca and the New York Review of Books. And before that, he majored in literature at Harvard. So he obviously knows quite a bit about criticism. And in his new book, Better Living Through Criticism, he builds on his knowledge of a number of forms of expression to examine criticism in a very broad sense. This book comes, of course, at a time that critical thinking itself appears under assault in the public arena. I think you all know what I'm talking about. When a certain anti-intellectualism has assumed prominence in our political dialogue and other open discussions. Tony, talking about the purpose of his book near the beginning of it, describes it as a manifesto against laziness and stupidity, but also in more positive terms, a celebration of art and imagination. He makes the case that criticism is not only one of the most creative ways to think, but that without it, creativity in literature, in the visual arts, and even in social and personal relationships would cease to thrive. As one reviewer in, where else, the New York Times, said of Tony's book, quote, if we were looking for an intelligent, informed, and often funny account of why we can't live comfortably with criticism and can't live without it either, we need look no further and shall probably want to read this book more than once. And not only the New York Times is praising the book, Publishers Weekly referred to it as a, quote, stunning treatise and, quote, a necessary work that may enter the canon of great criticism. Have I raised expectations too high for you? Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tony Scott.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction and for reading such excellent examples of criticism. thank you all for coming out on this very cold night. It's wonderful to see so many of you here. It's my belief that as William Wordsworth said of poetry in his introduction to his preface to the Lyrical Ballads, he said, a poet is really nothing more than a man speaking to men. And I think that a critic is just a person talking to other people. My idea of criticism that I lay out and defend in this book is as a form of conversation. So there will be, I hope, a lot of time for us to converse here, and I'm eager for your questions and your comments and your thoughts and on you know any topic that's relevant to the matter at hand, which is just about anything. From you know, one thing I haven't, because I've been focused on the publication of this book, I haven't had a chance to see Zoolander 2 or Deadpool. So if you have questions about those, I'm sorry, you'll have to consult my colleagues in the New York Times. Or any other paper. I want to talk a little bit about the genesis of this book, where it came from, what I was trying to do, or what I thought I was trying to do, and then what I ended up doing, which were slightly different things. But it was about 4 or 5 years ago. I began to notice certain themes popping up in different articles I would read or things I would see online, to the effect that. That critics were no longer needed, and that criticism, as I had been practicing it as a job and a profession and a vocation was pretty much done, because we have social media, we have Yelp, we have all these wonderful algorithms from Amazon that'll tell us what we like, that'll help us figure out what we like. We have friends who will share what they like with us on Facebook or on Twitter. And we have this whole wide open universe of Yelp and of user generated critical content. And so I was reading a lot of articles that were saying, well, you know, all those old guys, you know, sitting in their ivory towers telling everybody what to do, bossing everybody around, they're all finished and good riddance. And I thought, well, in some ways I would read these and my feelings would be a little hurt, because I would think, well, I like my job. I don't think I'm suited to doing any real work at this point in my life. I like sitting around and watching movies and then telling other people what to think about them, or at least sharing my own thoughts about them. So I was first inspired to take a stand against my own obsolescence and that of my colleagues. I thought, no, you know, people do need critics. Critics are important. I count. I matter. And then the second thought, because my mind kind of works always in contraries and in arguments with myself, I thought, well, maybe I don't. What if it's true? You know, why shouldn't everyone just decide for themselves? Why shouldn't people get together in like-minded groups in the real world or on social media and just do what they want? What do they need someone like me kind of coming in and interfering with that process, with their experience of films or books or music or whatever it is? So I wrestling with these questions, I thought this might be something interesting to write about. I had, as a lot of critics I think have over the years, written sort of pieces about the state of my own practice, the state of the art that I practice, the state of my own mind, sort of pushing back against misunderstandings about criticism, defending myself from other critics or from people who would question the necessity or the authority of criticism. But I thought, well, maybe it would be good to try to figure this out in a more systematic way, a more useful way, to say not only what does a critic do, not only kind of defend my own job, but talk about, well, what is the activity? What is criticism apart from how it's practiced by any individual critic? What are we doing when we're talking about works of art, when we're talking about what we like and why we like it, when we're saying, you know, this is better than that. When we go beyond just our own personal reactions and talking about what we liked or how we felt, and trying to argue about that and trying to bring that into some kind of discussion. So I set about reading and researching and wondering about the history of criticism and how people had thought about this over the years and over the centuries. The immediate inspiration for what the book became and the source of one of the epigraphs for the book and for a lot of the ideas in it is an essay by Oscar Wilde called The Critic as Artist, which is, like many of Wilde's essays, is kind of in the form of a play. It's a dialogue between two very Wildean characters named Ernest and Gilbert, who have this very long, night-long debate about art, about truth, about all of these lofty things. And Ernest is a very, as his name suggests, a kind of a flat-footed, literal-minded guy, and Gilbert is a more kind of dandyish, poetic figure. And right at the end, the dialogue concludes with Ernest summing up their conversation, summing up what Gilbert has told him, and saying, "You have told me many strange things tonight, Gilbert. You have told me that it is more difficult to talk about a thing than to do it, that to do nothing at all is the most difficult thing in the world.
You have told me that all art is immoral and all thought dangerous, that criticism is more creative than creation, and that the highest criticism is that which reveals in the work of art what the artist had not put there. That it is exactly because a man cannot do a thing that he is the proper judge of it. And that the true critic is unfair, insincere, and not rational. My friend, you are a dreamer. And Gilbert says, yes, I am a dreamer. For a dreamer is one who can only find his way by moonlight, and his punishment is that he sees the dawn before the rest of the world. His punishment, says Ernest, and his reward, says Gilbert. So I love that. You can imagine. I saw that passage and I said, yes, that's exactly right. It's people, you know, this is the answer when people say, well, you've never made a movie. How can you judge that one? And it's because I've never made a movie that I'm the most qualified to judge it. And if people say, you know, well, you're just reading something into there that wasn't exactly. That's exactly what I mean. So I thought, well, if I could kind of unpack that and expand that and explore that, I'd have something interesting to say. And about a year into it, as I was kind of struggling with the philosophical implications of these questions, which are quite serious and quite vexing, and I was kind of wrestling, trying to read Kant with no German and Aristotle with no Greek, and wishing that I'd never dropped out of graduate school and wishing that I'd never gone in the first place. I got assistance from a very important and somewhat unexpected source, the actor Samuel L. Jackson, who appeared in a movie some of you may have heard of or seen called The Avengers. I wrote a review of that movie, which is what, you know, what my job was to do. And it wasn't an especially negative review, because I actually liked quite a lot about that movie. I thought some of the performances were fun. There was some nice humor, some snappy dialogue. But there were also some things that bothered me about the movie, in particular just how a lot of its originality, a lot of its wit, a lot of the things that made it interesting were kind of compromised or smothered by the imperative to make it another big superhero movie, to put in these action sequences that were so much like so many other action sequences. And so I complained about that. And then the morning I think my review appeared, I went on Twitter, as one does when you're a serious intellectual in the 21st century. And my Twitter feed was full of the most extraordinary the most extraordinary abuse or the most imaginative rhetoric directed at me, suggesting all of these things that I might want to do with myself after I quit my job at the New York Times. And the source of that was a tweet that Samuel L. Jackson himself, who plays Nick Fury in the Avengers movies, had put up, where he said, Avengers fans, we need to find A.O. Scott a new job, one he can actually do. It actually was all in caps. So, and some of the Avengers fans were like, yeah, he needs a new job. And I was thinking, well, what do they want me to? What are they, if any of them are hiring, you know, maybe we can talk. But so I came back. I said something. I don't even remember what it was. It wasn't all that clever. But we had a little sort of back and forth on Twitter, which is sort of, you know, what you do. You used to do it in salons or coffee houses, and now you do it on Twitter. And the people in the entertainment media online had a good time with it, and there were little sort of articles about it, and little like Photoshop pictures of Samuel L. Jackson and me with lightsabers fighting with each other, and or him, you know, in his Pulp Fiction
character pointing a big gun at me. But I thought, well, but this is actually interesting because what is the job? How do you actually do it? He's kind of raised the question that that in a way haunts every critic because it is a very strange thing to do. It's a very strange kind of job to have, and it's not clear that any of us actually knows how to do it. It's not as if we have a license or we've been ordained at a seminary for critics and we now have this critic that we've been initiated into the mysteries of criticism and we now know how to practice it. And Jackson actually came back about 6 months later, sort of extraordinarily. Like a lot of actors and filmmakers never do this, and you sometimes wish that they would, in an interview he did with the Huffington Post where he came back to the review and developed his objections to it further and kind of said, well, the problem with the review is kind of twofold. On the one hand, he said, you know, this is a great movie, and this guy just didn't get it. And then on the other hand, he said, you know, this is just like – this is a piece of pop culture. It's a popcorn movie, and why does he have to intellectualize it so much? And those two questions, I thought, well, those are really like two of the main objections to what critics do and to criticism that that come around again and again. Why are you thinking so hard about this thing that we're just trying to do for fun? And also, why are you attacking this thing that is so perfect and so beautiful and so, you know, complete unto itself? And I think that those are serious questions, not to be dismissed. And they go to the heart not only of what critics do, but of what criticism is and how we think about and perceive and talk about these experiences in our lives, whether movies, books, works of popular art, or works of fine art, works that are accessible and fun and enjoyable, and also works that are difficult and challenging. What are we doing when we're taking these in? How much should we think about them? How do we take them seriously? And it was my view that, well, we need to take them seriously. We need You take a movie like The Avengers, there are all kinds of reasons to think about it and to take it seriously. Some of them just even economic. You know, if somebody is spending $200 million to make a movie, that seems like a significant thing that's going on in the world and is putting that out to try to, you know, to collect that money from all of us around the world. That seems like it's something worth thinking about and worth talking about and worth not trivializing. Similarly, the fact that we go to films or we read books or we listen to music or we go to museums to find pleasure and entertainment, but also meaning, also some reflection of and on our situation as human beings in the world, that doesn't seem to be something that should be trivialized or taken lightly or taken as given. That seems very much worth thinking about, worth talking about, worth reflecting on. And it's my argument in this book, and it's my conviction that that's where criticism begins. That that experience and the searching out of these experiences that we categorize as aesthetic or artistic is that thinking is where criticism begins, and that the work of translating our own responses to it, our own feelings about it, as strong and intense or as confused and diffuse as they might be, and then talking about it with each other and coming up with some kind of language to interpret and evaluate it and assess it is what criticism is. So that's what I found myself trying to defend and to articulate in this book, rather than and in a way it took me away from the circumstances of my own job and my own work, and it ended up being, I think, much more of an account of how we think about works of art, of how we think about pleasure and truth and beauty, and of what
these things mean to us than just a kind of a narrow defense of our ways of judging or of the professions of judgment that exist in the world. And I want to read just one more text. I'm not going to read anything, any of my own prose, because I don't want to spoil it for you guys if you or turn you off and say, yeah, I came here, I thought I was going to buy that book, and then he started reading it. I'll let you have that experience on your own. But I do want to end with a poem. I mean, I was, as Brad said, an English major, and before I was a film critic, I was a literary critic, and one of the great pleasures of working on this book was to return to some of that, and to use those muscles again, and to read some texts that were familiar and some that were unfamiliar to me that seemed to resonate with what I was talking about. So I found in the course of my research and my reading, a poem by Philip Larkin, wonderful English poet, a poem that I don't think is as well known as some of his others, but that I think is a really extraordinary poem in a lot of ways, in as with all of his poems, the ways that it reveals some very intimate dimensions of his own personality and grounds those in a common experience of the world, in this case, an experience of art. Larkin was himself a critic. He wrote about jazz for many, many years with great enthusiasm and insight and discernment. And this poem is kind of a jazz fan's note, in a way. The speaker in the poem is a solitary person walking by a dance hall and hears some music and stops to look inside and to listen. And the way that he talks about this experience, for me, kind of sums up where criticism comes from and where it goes. That is, it takes off from an immediate, sensual, even erotic experience with art, in this case with music, and tries to understand the connection between that and a higher, more cerebral, appreciative idea of art, and to think also about the tension between those things, between that sort of immediate pleasure of going out to the movies and having a good time, and the accompanying and maybe contradictory pleasure of thinking and feeling in a different way. So it's called Reasons for Attendance. The trumpet's voice, loud and authoritative, draws me a moment to the lighted glass to watch the dancers. All under 25, shifting intently, face to flushed face, solemnly on the beat of happiness. Or so I fancy, sensing the smoke and sweat, the wonderful feel of girls. Why be out here? But then, why be in there? Sex, yes, but what is sex? Surely to think the lion's share of happiness is found by couples, sheer inaccuracy, as far as I'm concerned. What calls me is that lifted, rough-tongued bell, art, if you like, whose individual sound insists I, too, am individual. It speaks, I hear. Others may hear as well, but not for me, nor I for them, and so with happiness. Therefore, I stand outside, believing this, and they maul to and fro, believing that, and both are satisfied, if no one has misjudged himself or lied. I hope you have some copies of Larkin's poems in your... Yes. If you don't buy my book, definitely buy his. So now, I mean, I think there is a lot for us to talk about. If you would, as Brad said, come to the microphones with your questions, we can spend the rest of the time talking about. I would caution you also, don't if you ask me for an Oscar prediction and you bet money and you lose, that's on you. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're the first one, yes.
How do you...
It's
Hello. You can hear. I wonder if you would comment on brain research that is being done to kind of get to the bottom of what artistic perception is and how it affects us emotionally and aesthetically. You say somewhere in here that this is not a science.
Yes.
But they seem to have established pretty well.
Well, I think, yes. I think there are a few things. If I'm an expert in anything, it is not brain science. There has been some really interesting research done in locating the neural pathways, and I'm sure I have all the language wrong, but the synaptic responses, what happens in the brain when it encounters works of art, and when something like aesthetic pleasure, as distinct from other forms of pleasure, as distinct from physical taste or sexual desire is happens. I am though in the book and in general somewhat skeptical, not of the content of this scientific research, but sometimes of its application, because very often what I find when neuroscience or evolutionary psychology begins to be applied to literature and in art is either a strangely kind of normative idea that, well, certain works of art are that we're going to be able to prove what's beautiful. We're going to be able to prove to kind of move from the subjective to the objective and solve the problem that criticism has never and philosophy have never been able to solve, which is, what is beauty? And I think that in order to do that, or that the arguments that you've discovered that are always smuggling value judgments in, under the guise of data, and that in fact, what is beautiful or what is pleasing, is the work of culture and cultural and social meaning making. So it's a little bit like language. You could say, well, we all have a capacity for language, right? I mean, you go back to the Chomsky revolution that proved that this is wired into us, that we generate meaning through language. We have these syntactic and semantic structures, deeply in our brain. And that's a very interesting fact. And I think it's probably also true that we have some kind of similar instinct toward beauty or toward aesthetic pleasure. But those theoretical ideas can't account for all of the wide variety of expressions of those structures. You see, because there are so many different languages. Languages keep changing. You can't get from the brain directly to any language. Or you can get to all of them. And I think the same is true with art. So in attempting just to kind of explain it all in the broadest sense, it leaves open all of the explanations of the particulars and leaves us with the same work that we've always had to do. That is to say, it's not going to help us. Like, we can know what's happening in our brain, but we're still going to have to argue about what it means, and that's still going to be a collaborative cultural conversational work. All right, please. That was a really hard question.
I have two questions. I think they're much easier though.
Okay.
The first one is you mentioned $200 million as being a significant event in the world. What kind of a sliding scale do you apply when it's a movie like Tangerine that's made on an iPhone, or that it's a little independent film? And the second one is really a very operational question about writing movie reviews, which I do as well, which is, how do you think about how much of the story you've got to tell without spoilers?
Two good questions. I think that it's important, especially with movies, to know a little bit and think about where they come from and how they were made. That isn't to say that there's an automatic correlation between budget, inverse or direct, and quality. But we live in it's a remarkable moment if you think about it, because it's the same digital technology in some ways, or a version of the same digital technology that enables these huge CGI action spectacles like the Avengers, is also what enables the Tangerine, which was, I mean, like, this is, you know, the cinematographer is working with that, and it's a beautiful movie, it's cinema. You know, there's no aesthetic compromise. You feel like it's more like the discovery of the great potential. But it's important to know that. You know, it's important to know that and to think about that and not hold movies to false standards. I mean, it's sometimes you hear people complain about things that movies didn't do, and you think, well, they had, you know, they had $100,000. They couldn't rent a crane, so they had to shoot that, you know, at ground level the whole time. And I think that art is always working, you know, with, as I think John Ruskin said, the resistance of the materials. You know, it's always constrained in some ways, and the way you judge it is how it operates within those constraints, and sometimes makes you forget that they're there. So you might sit down, you know, you read something about Tangerine and think, oh, this is interesting. This was shot on a cell phone. It'll only be a good movie if 10 or 15 minutes in you forget about that and you think, oh my God, what's going to happen to these characters? Like, what, you know, you're in the story, you're in the world. The plot question is a hard question because there's a great deal of spoiler sensitivity in the world, and you can sometimes feel like if you say anything that happened in the movie, someone is going to jump on you. And there's also the weird, you know, the fact that because of binge watching on television and because we watch things on streaming platforms, like what the spoiler statute of limitations is not clear. I think there was a whole Portlandia sketch about that, you know, but like how can I, like, okay, the, you know. The Sopranos has been off the air for right, or Rosebud, yes. My favorite Peanuts cartoon of where Linus is sitting and watching television, and Lucy comes in and she says, "What are you watching?" And he says, "Citizen Kane." And she says, "Rosebud is a sled," and she walks out of the room. And he loses his mind in that. But, you know, right. I mean, Anna Karenina throws herself under the train. Sorry. But you have to be careful. I mean, I seriously though. I mean, I get to see these movies before everyone else, and there are surprises in them. There are pleasures. Like I don't ever read anyone else's reviews, so because I don't want the movie spoiled. So I don't want to mess anyone else up that way. On the other hand, there are a certain number of people, and you are writing not just for opening day, but if not necessarily for all time, then for people who might want to come back and read what you wrote after they saw the movie. So you do kind of learn to be vague enough so that if you haven't seen the movie, this might go over your head, but to say enough that the person who has seen it will know what you're talking about and will appreciate it. Thanks.
I would have thought the need for critics was self-evident, especially today with all the video choices that we have. And I need to have somebody who watches more movies than I do and has good taste to tell me what they think. But sometimes I just check and see if there's a red, a ripe or a Rotten Tomato next to your name.
Yeah.
But my question is, with all the changes in the video marketplace and technology and all of that programming and how we access movies, do you think that the audience has different expectations of movies today, and do you have different expectations of a movie today?
It's a good question because there's such abundance, you know. We're really at a time of kind of an almost overwhelming glut of films and television shows and books and web video. I mean, the stuff that is demanding or soliciting our attention. there's more and more of it, and it's more readily available than ever before. So you can, you know, you can watch not just any new movie, but any old movie. It's much easier now. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, you would have to wait and see if something was going to come around at the Revival House, or, you know, if you wanted to see an old movie, you know, you'd have to either watch it late at night on TV, or you know, go to the campus film society, or check and see if maybe the museum was having a retrospective, and you would hear about, there would be these legendary movies that, you know, you would hope to get a chance to see, and you'd have to sort of make the time and make the effort. And now it's much easier, which is wonderful, but also can kind of devalue or make less special each individual thing. It's all here. It's all around us. It all starts to feel interchangeable. And I think that that means that some kind of guidance, or I don't mean even guidance in an authoritative sense, but it's like I think that what, as you said, a critic is someone who's seen more movies than you have, and maybe just a few, or is maybe like three episodes ahead of you on the TV show, who can kind of be a companion, you know, and you're like walking through this maze together, or this overgrown forest, trying to find, you know, what's interesting, trying to find a path through it. So I think that. This superabundance of material has made criticism more important, more vital, but also in some ways more difficult, more challenging, because there's nobody who can have seen it all. You know, the idea, which I don't think was you know, ever really true, but it was possible. You know, let's say in the 1970s and 80s. And 90s when kind of Roger Ebert was at the height of his powers, you know, he would review like eight movies a week in the Sun Times, you know, and five on his show, and would publish a guide at the end of every year of all the movies that had come out that year and what he thought of them, and that's impossible. Like, that, nobody could do that now. No army of digital bots could even do that. So we all kind of have to fumble around together and I think find the people that we trust to encourage us both to seek out what we might like, but also to go beyond our comfort zones to find new things.
I do have a couple of Ebert's books, yeah. But in your instance, how far in advance are you given the opportunity to see the film or to read the book and then to make the comments? And are there any reactions as a result before publication or release?
No reactions before publication. No one. I mean, my editors see it, obviously, yes. But there's no. It's entirely you know, independent of any of the people involved with the movie. I mean, sometimes as I've discovered, having become recently the object of criticism as well as the author of it, sometimes as a courtesy, like, they'll send you, but it's already printed. I mean, it's not a rough draft. So like a week in advance, they'll send a PDF of the proof of the magazine. So you can, you know, you can prepare your response or your suicide note or whatever. But that doesn't really apply in the case of movies. The answer about how far in advance really varies, because movies come into the world in different ways. So sometimes they'll be at film festivals months before they're released theatrically, and when we go to film festivals, film critics will see them there, and then we'll always see them again closer to the time that they're going to be released, so that we can refresh our sense of them and also just so that we're writing about them at a time when our readers can go see them. Sometimes, though, you just have a couple of days. You know, a lot of big commercial movies don't like
you know, want to control as much as they can the timing of the reviews that come out, and don't want anything to interfere with their marketing and publicity campaign. So, you know, very often you'll see a movie, say, Tuesday night that's opening Friday, and then, you know, you have to make the deadline. You know, you have all day Wednesday to write it.
It'll be in the Thursday or Friday paper.
It'll be in Friday's paper. Now, with the web, it'll sometimes go up. They like to put the Friday reviews on the web, you know, on Thursday morning. So there's a certain amount of deadline pressure. You sometimes have to work quickly, but sometimes you have a couple of weeks. And sometimes you get to see a movie more than once. But I've always found in most cases it's enough time. I mean, the thing about newspaper deadlines that's so wonderful and so cruel is there's always enough time, because you have to be finished by the time it leaves the copy desk.
Do you want to tell us your favorite movie of all time?
Sure, it always changes. I always go back to Fellini, and I go back to La Dolce Vita, because that's a movie, you know, that I would most even though it's a movie about sorrow and alienation and emptiness, I would, you know, I'd rather live in that movie than any other. Thank you. Yeah.
This may be a bit technical, but it's about you. I'm too young to say I've been a long-time reader, but I've been enjoying your reviews. And one of the things that me and my dad like to spot in your reviews when we catch up is this thing that you often do with movies that you like, is that something's both a thing and its opposite. I think our favorite example is on your review of The Tree of Life, Terrence Malick, where you say it's both a world void of God and godly or something, or full of it or something like that. And you also do it in the book and the Samuel L. Jackson example. Yeah. Like, it's outside of criticism but also beyond it, and I was wondering if that's like do you look for those things that embody contrarianism? Is that
I think that's style? Just that's a, I now I'm going to be very self-conscious every time I do that. It's like, oh my god, that's just what that guy said I always do.
But the ones you like.
But I think I do have I just a taste, yes, for paradox and contradiction, and I mean it's in the book a lot. Mm-hmm. But I do like the way that some works of art can do that, can be both one thing and its opposite. And I think it's also just a tick of my writing style. And I do find sometimes when I'm editing my pieces or going on with the editor, you know, there's just a few too many sentences that are like, it is at once blah 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 and blah blah blah. It is at the same time. Da, 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 da. It's like, okay, that's five of those in one paragraph. We need to do
those
something
are
else.
My favorite sentences.
Well, good. So, all right, I'll keep writing them then. I'll write more.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Number 8 on your list of 10 best films of 2015 was Mad Max Fury Road, which you called a return to old-fashioned linear storytelling. For me, linear means one-dimensional, and that's a generally pejorative term. Another Fury Road kind of film, old-time, was Stagecoach.
Yep.
How can you even think of them in the same paragraph?
Well, because I think they're part of the same tradition. I mean, I think that they I think that a lot of great Westerns are precisely linear. You know, they're moving across the landscape in a line. I mean, Stagecoach is a great example. They are point A to point B journeys. The Mad Max journey is a little bit more moves in a little bit more of a circle, but what I loved about it, and what I would defend about it, just in those formal terms, is that it you know, it's a car chase movie or a cavalry movie. It's doing things with action that belong to an older cinematic vocabulary of action that I really like and that I kind of miss, when everything is sort of flying through space and when you can use CGI to kind of to warp three dimensions and to make sometimes very entertaining and astonishing spectacles. But just the fact that these were all like vehicles moving around in actual space, I thought was really exciting. I also just found, you know, that I thought it was a very potent allegory. It really, you know, I like the politics of the movie as well. So I think it's not that, you know, I think that, that what a filmmaker like George Miller is trying to do with his characters and with the way he's sending them out into the world to make decisions under duress and to show through physical action often what is happening to the characters is not that different from what John Ford was trying to do. So that would be my short answer. But if it wasn't your thing, that's, you know, that's cool too.
I was just wondering if you had read the recent Atlantic criticism of your work, and specifically its attack on your love of brunch.
Well, okay. See, this now things are getting very serious. But go ahead.
I mean, and I was just wondering, you know, be the piece what it may, perhaps the like, are there ways in which the criticism comments on, you know, the way in which a film critic like yourself now also has the ability to write, like in the 2014 piece you did on Adulthood about television, sort of cross-medium, right. Like the commitment of being a film critic.
So this piece, which I do recommend by by Leon Wieseltier, your fellow Washingtonian, I think, which is, you know, not my problem. In the Atlantic, I mean. He's an extremely learned person and a brilliant writer, and especially I think brilliant at invective, at just sort of and you know, I was in a way honored to be a target of that for being a shallow dilettante and not a critic, but I think he says a man on the scene. Although I'd say unlike Leon, I've never had lunch at the Four Seasons with Henry Kissinger, but we all have our own scene. But what I value, I'll get to the brunch question in a minute.
Okay, it's important.
This is really a sore spot. But what I value about that review is that it does, I think, make clear a very interesting and consequential temperamental and philosophical difference between Wieseltier and myself. That is, it's not just about, I think, my own failings as a person and a writer and a person of taste, but about an idea of sort of where do you come at this from? And I think that that Leon is committed to an idea of philosophical commitment and likes, as anyone who has read him, I think, knows, to proceed from a position of metaphysical certainty and to know his own mind. And I proceed from a very different place. I proceed from confusion and from trying in the process of writing to make up my mind and to figure out what I think. I think also to go even kind of deeper into the philosophical weeds. I mean, if there is an intellectual tradition that I would claim this book belongs to, it would probably be that of pragmatism, of a line that I think goes from Emerson through William James, certainly to John Dewey, whose art and experience is an important kind of part of the infrastructure of this book. And Wieseltier, you know, if you've read him over the years, he is extremely hostile to that tradition, and that's, you know, I think it's very useful to have that argument out there, and I'm grateful for that piece. But in order to sort of clinch his case and kind of, you know, pin me to the mat as the shallow dilettante that I am. He says at the end, you know, yes, Scott believes in beauty and pleasure and truth and art, but most of all, he believes in brunch. All right. So this I actually called a lawyer when I read that, because in fact, I'm good friends and have been for many years with Sam Sifton, the former restaurant critic and current food editor of the New York Times. And I share with him an absolute hostility to brunch, and a deep aesthetic and philosophical commitment to its. I mean, I just thought that that really kind of outraged me, because you could say you could say a lot about me, you know, and it might be fair, but it's either breakfast or it's lunch.
Okay.
So, clear that. All right.
Hi.
Hi.
So you stated that you see the movies ahead of time. Are you seeing them by yourself or with people? It wasn't clear to me because when I think of movies, it's such a could be such a shared,
yeah,
collective democratic experience, and it totally changes how I could view a movie. And I do you see that if you, yeah, are watching them alone or versus?
I'm usually others? Not. I'm usually not alone. I mean, I don't watch them at home. They don't send except very rare cases when it's such a small release, you know, that they can't afford to rent a screening room. They'll send me a DVD, but my preference is always to see it projected because it looks better that way and there's less distraction. But also because of what you say, that to have other people in the room, even if they're just other critics, which is often the case, is, you know, does give you something more. Sometimes just a sort of an intangible sense of how the movie is working. And for a lot of commercial releases, and really often my favorite ways to see movies, it's sort of it is in a big movie theater. It'll be a sneak preview at a multiplex, and there'll be like a couple rows designated for critics and press, but it's mostly just, you know, people coming to see the movie, and it's you both feel that kind of democratic experience, but you can also get some interesting information about how a movie is working with its intended audience, you know. So if you're seeing a comedy, you know, with a bunch of teenagers and they're not laughing, you think, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting. Or you see a horror movie and everybody is laughing, that'll tell you something else. So it's not as if that determines necessarily what you think, but it's interesting to observe. It's useful to know, and sometimes it really, I think, makes a huge difference. I still, one of the most memorable screening experiences was at one of these big, it was in Chicago actually, but it was at a huge multiplex sneak preview screening of the second Twilight movie, and you know, like, I was one of three people in that audience who was not either a 12-year-old girl or her mother. So, but it was very, it's like, I definitely needed to know what was going on with all of those people around me to understand what this movie was, because it maybe was not a movie that, like, a 45-year-old guy would be the target audience for. But I quite enjoyed it, so.
Yeah. Hi, Tony. Thank you for all your wise words.
Thank you.
You mentioned Roger Ebert earlier. I would appreciate your insight onto two pieces of Ebert's film criticism philosophy, which I've encountered. The first is that he rejects the notion that we have to rank movies, make lists of the 100 greatest films ever, our 10 all-time favorite musicals, whatever. He says that's unnecessary, it's meaningless, it's pretentious, it's demeaning to all the other great films that don't make the cut. And two, what is a great film? He's stuck by the definition of it's a movie that you couldn't bear the thought of never seeing again.
Mm-hmm.
What say you?
Well, I like that second one. I got to know Roger pretty well at the end of his life, and he was a great influence on me as on anyone who does this. I mean, I do think. More and more that he did it better than probably anyone else will or has, with more, you know, with more heart and soul, with more just of his complete personality. And I think that, yeah, a great movie is one that in a way you can't imagine not seeing again, and that you're always seeing. That's always there. That's always with you. I think to sidetrack a little bit, the other thing that I think he said really wonderfully that I think about a lot is the power of the movies is I think his phrase was they're machines that produce empathy. And he described the remarkable thing about movies is that you're sitting in the dark and you're watching these people who you may have nothing in common with, who aren't even real, and you care about what happens to them. You care about what happens next. You want to know what is going to happen, and that's a remarkable thing. I mean, and I think that he was very aware of that power, and He was always very generous, sometimes generous to a fault, I think, about movies. But he was always hard on movies that betrayed that power. You know, that didn't that were sort of cheap or cynical or corrupt in their view of human life. The list making thing, I mean, it's the, we all hate it, we all complain about it, but we all, you know, we all do it. It's just like, you can tell your editor, you know, no, I'm not making a list this year. And you'll have a long, this happens every year, you know. Some of us are like, no, we don't want to do it. But, you know, the readers want it, the editors want it. It's I think it's important not to invest too much in the lists or to believe that they represent anything other than just a kind of the thoughts of a moment. I mean, I sometimes look back at my 10 best lists for previous years and I'm just like, what the, you know, that one really, number four, really? But they're sort of there. They provide a useful service each year because there are movies. You know, people who are reading the newspaper and going to the movies are very busy and don't always have a chance to see something. And especially now, you know, that things are streaming and so available, you know, readily available. It's like, oh, here's this movie that came out in February, and you know, came and went really quickly from screens. And here's just a chance to remind readers, you know, oh, that, you know, check that one out. So I think if you sort of step down from the idea that this is, you know, representing some kind of definitive statement or ranking, and that it's just something that is useful and amusing, then you can sleep at night after you've made your list.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I was curious about your process for writing your film reviews. Do you do a lot of preparatory work beforehand? Do you read about the production? Do you take notes during the screenings? How often do you watch a movie multiple times?
I usually can only watch it once, just because the volume and the schedule is such that when you're doing, you know, a couple hundred a year, that's a lot of hours. But I do when I can see things again. As I was saying before, you know, I see them usually in the theater. I don't see them with the benefit of being able to stop and go back. It was one of the hardest things in making a transition from writing about books to writing about movies is the book is there. You know, you can dog ear it, you can put post-its in it. If you forgot something, you can go back. The movie is closer to a performance. It's closer to being a theater critic or an opera critic or a sports writer. You know, you're getting to see something once from beginning to end, and you have to describe it and characterize it based on that. So you learn a very attentive kind of viewing, and I do take notes more in some ways just to keep my attention focused than to go back to, because they tend actually I think they tend to look like that because it's dark, no one uses any flashlights. I try not to know too much about the movie going in, because I like the experience to be fresh. I want as much of a tabula rasa as I can, but I do also like to do whatever background seems necessary or interesting. So, you know, to read the book if it's based on a book, if there's other work by the filmmaker that I'm not familiar with or that I need to refresh myself on, I'll go back and watch that. Sometimes, you know, if a movie is about real historical events, I'll want to look into those and think about, not necessarily for the purpose of saying whether it got it right or wrong, because there's really no form of writing about movies that I hate more than the, you know, what X gets wrong about Y, what Steve Jobs gets wrong about Steve Jobs. But anything that might be useful, you know, there's not a single program for all movies. Every movie kind of, I have a limited amount of space and some pressure on my time, so I want to figure out, well, what is it that I need to know? You know, what would help me make a good argument, or what's the information that I would need that would, I do learn what I can about the production, although the production notes that the studios give you are not always the most useful in that regard, because they're just sort of propaganda. Everyone talking about how great. I mean, you read those and you would never think there was a problem on any movie. You know, everyone was just like, I've always wanted to work with this director. It was such an amazing journey, blah, you know. again and again. Okay. Okay. Lightning round.
Sure. My question is about At the Movies.
All right.
I really enjoyed your iteration of it with Michael Phillips. I was wondering if we can expect any future collaboration with him, and also sort of how you think that show fits into the world of criticism that you talk about in the book.
I think that show, especially when Siskel and Ebert did it, was for me in a way the almost the perfect representation of what criticism is, because it's two people talking. It's an argument. It's an endless argument. My when I was getting ready to be on the show, I was watching a bunch of old clips on my laptop. My daughter came in and she was about I think 8 or 9 at the time. She sat down and she watched it with me, and she said, "These guys just fight all the time. Even when they agree, they fight about it." And they had something. It was very hard. It was impossible to duplicate that. One of the problems. Michael Phillips is a wonderful critic and a good friend, and we just agreed too much, and we were too polite. You know, he's just like a very decent, kind Midwestern guy, and so, you know, the producer would just go crazy trying to get us to like sharpen it. You know, but I hope it sort of frustrates me that there's not more room for that kind of. I mean, the broadcast world has changed, and that was a weekly syndicated show, and those don't really exist anymore. And there is stuff, there's definitely stuff online. There are podcasts, there are web videos, but I do think it's strange that the model of arguing on camera, which you could say Roger and Gene kind of invented, is now all you see on cable television. And I've always wondered, like, why we could have that about politics endlessly. And is there room for an hour a day where we could have it about culture, about movies? I mean, which are things that people care about and argue about. And I don't know if it's just that they're sort of corporate issues that the companies that would broadcast these things are also invested in making the stuff that would be talked about. I don't know. But I do feel like there's room for it. I would love to see it come back. And Michael and I, if anyone wants to call us, we're available.
Okay, we got just
last three. Okay.
Thanks for coming. One of the things I like about your writing is it's popular criticism. It's both suggests some deeper thinking about the material, but it's also made accessible and direct for a general audience. So I was curious, since I enjoy that about your writing, if there are things that are both satisfying about that limitation and dissatisfying.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I think it's mostly satisfying. I mean, I really like working for a daily newspaper. I really like the idea that I'm writing for an audience that is literate and smart and curious, but not necessarily in possession of any special knowledge or intense focused interest. So I have to imagine that I'm talking to everybody, and the paper has kind of ways of ensuring that, you know, just and sometimes that's frustrating. Like sometimes when the copy editors make you explain, you know, when you have to say the prominent French film director Jean-Luc Godard, and you're just, or you know, English pop band The Beatles. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but sometimes, you know, you'll think, well, the copy editor is like, well, I've never heard of this, and you think, well, but come on. But that's better, you know. I think it's better than the opposite. It's better because I think there's a lot of film criticism and other criticism in the arts out there that is too specialized. It's too insular. That's too much assuming a kind of a coterie knowledge and kind of speaking almost in codes. And having come from academia, I'm very happy to be free of that. Yeah, so I think it's I'm mostly just very, very satisfied with it and very happy with it and very grateful that
that the paper has also just let me kind of experiment and find a voice and write in a way that makes sense to me. I did not really expect when I started at the New York Times, and I'm still continually surprised by how much freedom there is within its pages. I mean, except, you know, to swear, but that's okay, you know.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi there. Speaking of academia, did you look into this discourse, critical thinking that goes on in academia? It's kind of a body of dialogue, and what do you think that's applicable to, and is what's the overlap of what you've done and that body of dialogue?
I'm not very up on that kind of formal academic discourse. I mean, I sometimes I'm a little suspicious, having encountered that word a lot, like in my own children's education, where it sometimes does seem like an alternative to actually learning stuff, you know, that they're going to learn critical thinking, but what are they going to think about? So as a pedagogical matter, I sort of think, well, that the two should go hand in hand. But I do think that the idea that, that people's minds work and develop by reflecting on their own premises and assumptions and subjecting them to kind of to questioning and to guided skepticism is close to what I'm getting at. I mean, I don't know enough about it as an academic discipline or
fields
or
of study that are looking at themselves.
Right, exactly.
It's self-reflective.
It's self-reflective, and I think that can go too far. You know, I think again because you can lose a sense of the content or of the object of the thought. But I do think it is how it's how our intelligences work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, so I think you'll be the last one.
Hi, AO. I actually was introduced to your work through your critics' picks on YouTube for the New York Times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, great stuff.
Thank you.
I want to be a film critic. I started writing lists recently for Taste of Cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I've heard your position on that. But in the case of, I just was wondering what your take on the site is. It's, from what I've read, it's of it and what I'm writing for it. It's like an in-depth way of looking at films within the list format.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that any format is what you make of it, and I think that you know, the list, for some reason, I don't really know why, but the lists are very popular. That's what drives traffic somehow on media. But I think that it is possible to do real criticism in the lists or about the list. So in the last couple of weeks, for some reason, everybody was making their Coen Brothers list, and. In a way, it's not, you know, you can't necessarily take it seriously as a question. Like, we're going to decide, you know, is it Serious Man number 3 or is it number 4? Is Fargo better than The Big Lebowski or is it worse than Miller's Crossing? I mean, it's an endless and absurd debate. And you could picture a room full of characters in a Coen Brothers movie having it. Like, I don't know if you've seen Hail Caesar, but, you know, all those Marxists in their beach house in Malibu kind of saying, no, but. But on the other hand, if it gets you thinking and talking about the stuff that is interesting and examining, because it's hard. The other thing about making lists that you know better than I do is it's really hard and you try. I mean, it gets you get into these very intense kind of hermeneutic quandaries about, well, what is, like, what's the difference if this is number 3? Like, I always find at the end of the year, number 1 is easy, number 2 is not that hard, but like, number, what's the difference between number 6 and number 7?
Oh yeah.
And I push right up against my deadline, just like flipping them around, you know. No, it's 7. No, that one's 9. That one's 8. And you know, that in a way is an example of the absurdity of it, but it's also like, yeah, the there is something. I mean, and I think it is connected to, you know, I mean, to say in the book quite a lot that there is this human impulse to judge, to sort, to evaluate. That's part of what we're always doing, and I think that ranking and list making is part of that too. But like all other forms of criticism, it's
it's endless work, and it's always, you know, and you're always going to be wrong. Someone's always going to find fault. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
And thank you all.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.